Hello, everyone, and welcome to Minute 49 of Season 7 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1995 Bruce Willis action film Die Hard with a Vengeance, 1 minute at a time. And not only is this the 49th episode of this season, but it is also my 800th episode of the entire podcast so far, which I'm amazed at. And miraculously or surprisingly or however you want to look at it, today is actually 3 years to the day, July 4th, since I started, this podcast, this entire series. So I just want to once again thank everyone for who helped me get to this milestone. And it's great. So I'm Rob. And
thank you for your dedication. 800 episodes in 3 years is truly impressive.
Impressive. I took a hiatus because of a little war that's going on here for 2 weeks. So, otherwise things would have maybe even been, I would be at a later further along number at this point, if not. But, oh, well, that's the way it is. And again, it worked out great that, 800 hits exactly on the anniversary of the podcast beginning. So yeah, no complaints there. So I'm Rob, and joining me today for my 800th episode is my good friend Sean German of the Next Scene Pod. Welcome back, Sean, and welcome to 800.
Yeah, welcome to 800. That's quite a milestone. I feel very fortunate and blessed to be a guest this special day. So thank you very much for having me. This is exciting.
Yeah. Well, you do know that you're here randomly.
I'm just going to pretend.
No offense. That
of
no
all
offense.
The guests you could have had, you planned ahead, and you were like, for 800, we got to do something special. Get me Sean or no one. We're not doing it. We're going to stop this $7.99 if I can't get Sean. That's what happened in my mind, at least.
Okay, that's fair. That is very fair. So there you go. Exactly. So minute 49 begins with car after car leaving the motor pool and ends with Walsh telling a story. So basically, the way we ended things yesterday yesterday's minute was almost entirely, the NYPD getting ready for this whole thing and seeing Simon's reaction to everything that they're doing to get ready. So it was done really well. I liked watching how that all played out yesterday, but today that we continue with that. And basically, we see a whole bunch of cars just leaving the motor pool. And then we see a great shot of a bunch of cops just standing by payphones, waiting in line. My interpretation of this scene is that these are all the cops that now have to call home and tell them that they're going to be late. That they're not finishing their shift now. That's my interpretation. How would you interpret it of what's going
on? That makes more sense than what I was thinking. So I was thinking this was maybe these are officers that are leaving a school. They've just done a search and they've got to call in. They can't use the radio, so they've got to call back to the switchboard to say, I've searched XYZ, all clear, kind of thing. But that kind of doesn't make sense. It's a little premature for that because the order just went out for them to start this search. So it'd be jumping ahead quite a bit in time for them to be at that point. So I guess, that makes sense. These are people calling out to say, we're going to be working late, which is funny. I like that because it's even funnier later in the minute where was it Walsh who's talking about, it's shift change.
That's right.
To explain all the activities, saying, the bean counters are worried about overtime. Where here we see, all these police that are calling home because they're going to be doing a lot of overtime.
That's
for the extra work that's coming up. So
exactly.
I like your explanation better. That makes much more sense.
Because also we know what time it is. This whole thing started at 11:45. So this is around 12 o'clock. So it must be that they're changing the shifts at noon, And now what's really funny, if you freeze frame at 6 seconds, one of the there's a whole bunch of cops that are on the phone, and there's a guy in the background with a mustache. Do you see what I'm talking about?
Yes.
Who does that remind you of? Ooh. It reminds me of someone that you did a podcast about.
It's a little bit, there's like some Bill Murray flavor there.
I see Bill Murray flavor. That's right. That's what I see.
Could be like, you know, I wouldn't be mistaken for a Bill, but if you told me that was one of the Murray brothers, yeah.
Well, that's actually interesting when you say that, because I don't think any of the other brothers look alike, you know, but okay. That's fair. But
yeah,
you know, well, when you freeze frame it, it does look like him.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
We can go into IMDb and write that Bill Murray has a cameo in Die Hard with a Vengeance.
In Die Hard, yeah. Just observing this scene, because I'm wondering, you know, how often do you see, you know, cops lining up at this bank of payphones?
That's right. And it's not just beat cops. You see, you know, a couple guys in suits that are going to, you know, to go to the phones also, and you mm-hmm. then you see just pedestrians looking around wondering why there are so many cops there, I guess.
Yeah,
you know, but whatever, it's a nice, I like the shot. I like the way that they do this with all these cops here, and then the shot changes and we see a door that you can read that says communication section 911. So back with the people standing in line. So we hear a lot of commotion and dialogue from all the cops that are standing at the payphones, and we hear someone say, "Hey, hold on, let me get over there, and I got to get through." So again, those comments make it sound as if my theory might be correct about the fact that these are mm-hmm. people that, you know, I got to quickly get in touch and tell my wife I can't go pick up the kids or whatever it is,
right?
That type of thing. And then the scene changes, and we get a door with that. You see the glass on it, and then you can read that it says communication section 911.
Mm-hmm.
And then they do a very interesting thing. They pan to the right, and we see a you know, a cubicle. Now, did you read any of the signs on the cubicle before we get there?
I just saw, so there's a nameplate, Wanda Shepherd.
Okay, but before you even get to her name, before that, yeah, you see,
I didn't,
there's a sign that says, did you make all necessary notifications?
Notifications.
And then you see her name, and it says that she's the monitor. Yes, you are correct. And you also see that she deals with D5, 12 to 14 precincts. I guess that's what it is. And like, she just sticks her head out of the cubicle and has this hilarious look on her face. Now, do you know who this actress is?
I did look her up, like, just in the cast list for this film, but I didn't recognize her, and I did not look up to see what else she's done.
Okay, so her name is Phyllis Yvonne Stickney, and she has 32 IMDb credits. And she she's a stand-up comedian, mm-hmm. which is perfect for this type of role, you know, because of the, you know, the facial contortions that she does here, you know, are hilarious with the way that she does this. And then she like slowly gets up and moves around, and she basically realizes that nobody else is around.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she looks around. They give us a great POV shot from her looking at all the empty cubicles, trying to figure out what the hell is going on. And then, like, in the distance, she sees someone in a cubicle. But that's it.
Yeah. And well, there's
a woman.
You can see we were talking about the lights on the cars, on the unmarked cars. There's lights on top of the cubicles, red lights that are all on. I assume that means someone's on a call.
Probably, yeah.
And they're all lit up.
Correct. And again, she's the monitor, so maybe she's, you know, is she the monitor or the anti-monitor? But she's, you know,
she's monitoring.
She's in charge of wondering what's going on. She sees how busy they are here. So she starts walking out of her cubicle, and she starts screaming, "Sergeant Turley! Sergeant Turley!" And then she ends up walking through that glass door that we saw before, and passing by you know, a woman by a photocopy machine, and she gets to her boss, And she said, and he turns around and holds up his hands as she's talking. And she goes, in the last 5 minutes, the volume of calls here has tripled. What the hell is going on? And he goes, stop. Let me explain. For the rest of the day, we're supposed to handle the department's communications. What do you mean handle? They're shutting down the police band. All calls will be coming through this switchboard. And, you know, her comment from 1994 is very different reactions than people would get today, where she says, and I'm going to marry Donald Trump.
Yeah.
And so I stay as far away from politics here as possible. So we will not be discussing anything political about Donald Trump. Do you know what his middle name is? Because he's always Donald J. Trump. Do you know his middle name?
Is it John? I'm just going to go with like the most common J name I can.
Yes, it is. It is John.
Okay.
It is John.
Yeah.
He was born on June 14th, 1946. And he received a degree in economics from the University of Pennsylvania in 1968. And in 1971, his father already named him the president of the real estate business that they owned. And then he ended up renaming it the Trump Organization.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny slash ha-ha funny, depending on your viewpoint. But yeah, before entry into politics, before even show business, The Apprentice and that sort of stuff, Donald Trump was a big figure around New York City and Manhattan, you know, real estate and kind of the rich people society pages and that sort of stuff. So there's a few mentions and appearances in movies from the 80s and 90s that we would view much differently today than they would have at that time.
Yes. That's very true. But it's still funny that it comes up, you know, showing how timely this movie can be.
Yeah, there you go. It's evergreen there. For sure. Yeah.
So the actor who plays Sergeant Turley is named J.R. Horn. And he was born in 1944 and passed away in 2016 at the age of 72. He had 30 IMDb credits, and his nickname was Cannonball.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
he's a little bit of a, like, you know, that guy where, like, I see him, I'm like, I know that face. I know I've seen him before. I have no idea what his name is. Like, if you gave me 50 guesses without looking at IMDb, I never would have guessed his name, but I absolutely recognize this guy from other things he's done. So he's one of, you know, he's a that guy for me in movies.
Okay. Makes sense. And he was also a disc jockey from 1967 to 1972 at KDKA radio, wherever that might be. But it's a nice little, you know, bit here, once again, giving us some exposition as to what was decided, and, you know, that everything on the radio band will now be going through this switchboard. And Wanda
Wanda's not happy. But, you know, kind of giving us that insight into the larger world, the bigger picture of what's going on. While, you know, while we're focused on John McClane and Zeus and Simon and what they're doing, there's a whole city around them that's also reacting to these events. So we get a little glimpse into that world and how this is affecting some other people.
Yeah, for sure.
I thought this was interesting that that Sergeant Trump, I guess he's a sergeant, I guess he's police, but he's carrying a gun, you know, he's, you know, working the call center, but I guess in case the call center gets invaded or something, he's strapped, he's carrying his piece.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that he is.
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I love how he uses his hands to as he's talking.
Yeah. Because he's right. Because he knew this was coming. He knew, you know, as soon as the announcement went out, you know, and there's going to be increased, you know, call traffic volume. They're going to be very busy, and you know, he knew someone's going to come barge through that door, and probably Wanda, because she's the monitor. You know, she'd be coming in, so he's all prepared. He knows. He knows she's not happy. He also knows she doesn't have a choice, that this is, you know, this is the way things are going to be for at least the next few hours.
Correct.
Yeah, he's ready for it.
He actually reminds me a little bit of Patton Oswalt with the way that his, you know, he uses body language.
Yeah, he's got a kind of Patton Oswalt kind of feel.
Yeah.
Or Patton Oswalt's got a J.R. Horn kind of feel.
Maybe.
Considering this guy came first. He did it first. Patton's the imitator there.
Maybe.
He's gotten his tie is completely unknotted. He's got the top button on his shirt unbuttoned. This guy's having a day. It's barely noon, and his day is going about as predictably or as well as Wanda's is. So he's in it too. He's going through whatever they're going through.
And then the shot changes, and we're back in the street near Wall Street, and we see a whole bunch of reporters, standing on the other side of the police line. And we see like a guy with a pen, a paper, and a pencil, and we see in the background that says News New York, and then one of them, a woman starts screaming. She goes, "Hey Walsh, what's going on? Why'd everyone tear out of here?" And then he responds to her, "Come on, Pamela, look at your watch. It's coming up on shift change. The bean counters are worried about overtime." So we sent everyone back to, and then he gets cut off. So again, we talked about this earlier in the week. IMDb is a little inconsistent with names and characters in this movie, because there is no Pamela listed there. We do have female reporter. So I'm assuming that it is her. Her name is Dory Binyam. I think that's how it's pronounced. Hmm. And she doesn't have very many credits on IMDb. She has a total of 3 credits. So this was her prominent, film role, I guess you can say.
This is her big known for reporter in Die Hard with a Vengeance.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, Dory Binyam. Binyon. Yeah, I assume it's her, but there's no picture. It's very interesting that the way that she says it, she realizes what's going on here, and Walsh needs to try and cover it up as well as possible. Because you see on her face that she doesn't buy it.
Right.
Yeah,
he's given her a story. She knows it. He knows it. He knows that she knows it. She knows that he knows it.
Exactly. And, it does sound plausible. The fact that okay, it's noon, and, he wouldn't say, okay, we're running shifts at 4, so we're going to do it now at noon. No, it makes sense that it's something that's relatively close, or coming up soon. Like, I don't know how the shifts work in the NYPD, so I couldn't take it from that perspective. Mm-hmm. And
yeah, but they had this explosion, and while they haven't announced they haven't announced to the public that they know there are more bombs, it's reasonable to guess that there'd be at least a suspicion that there may maybe more explosions coming. So to have any time where they're not fully staffed, to have even the few minutes between shift changes, the cops on the scene pull out, and then waiting for the next round to pull in, doesn't exactly make sense at that point.
No.
Yeah,
I agree with
you. But that's that's his story, and he's sticking to it, and she's not buying it for a second. Nope. As well, she shouldn't. That's important for the reporters and journalists in a democratic free speech society, that they should be critical. Well, in all societies, but the journalists should be critical of the government and should eye with suspicion everything that they say. But especially in this point, because it really doesn't make sense. I don't think the bean counters are calling the shots if there's an explosion under Wall Street.
Yeah.
Right. At least I hope not. I hope you would, the bean counters calling the shots in that situation. But yeah.
That's right.
They both have their jobs to do. She's asking the questions, and he is not answering them.
No, not at all.
Yeah.
So, they do talk about bean counters. So what do you know about a bean counter?
I know that's a term for an accountant. or, you know, the controller, the person who's controlling the money or, the purse strings in an organization, usually a derogatory term, usually not a term of affection for accountants or people that that handle money.
Right. Now, do you know where it comes from? Do you know, like, why they're referred to as a bean counter?
I do not. I would hazard a guess that at some point, beans counted for coins or currency. So there may have been, actual literal, counting of beans. But that's just a guess. I don't know, but I have a feeling you're about to illuminate me.
Yes, I am. Yes, I am. So basically, they used to use abacuses. Mm-hmm. Right.
Oh, okay.
So the beads on an abacus are also known as beans.
The abacus. Okay. Well, that makes sense.
Yes. There we go. But there are other reasons. There are other suggestions of how it came to be. It's one of those things that no one knows for sure specifically where it came from, because part of the whole thing is it was. It the English came from somewhere else. So, because it originally came from German, and so the idea is that they were talking about that a bean counter is like someone who's penny pinching, and they couldn't see the bigger picture, and they just looked at the small picture right in front of them, the actual beans or coins that they're dealing with also.
Right.
In the 80s, it started becoming. Understandable that it is a derogatory term. So usually when you use it nowadays, you're dealing with someone who's like a nitpicker. That's the idea of calling someone a bean counter. In 1994, when this movie theoretically is taking place, I don't know. So I don't know if that, where that fits in within that. But what's very interesting is here's another throwback to a previous season. In one of my previous seasons, we also discussed bean counters. Any clue which season?
Yeah.
Let's see if you can guess.
Bean counters. Well, it's A Wonderful Life has a banking plot and dealing with money, and bean counters might come up there.
It was not It's a Wonderful Life. It was a season you were on. How's that?
A season I was on.
Yeah. I can't guarantee that you were that you were on those episodes. I have a feeling you were not.
I have a feeling I was not. Yeah, I don't know. I have a feeling it's When Harry Met Sally, but I'm trying to think of the scene where like bean counters might have come up, and I can't come up with anything. I don't know.
Nope, you're gonna have to guess again.
No. We're running out of seasons.
Yes, we are.
Is it Die Hard 2?
No.
Well, I know. Obviously, money was part of the plot in Die Hard with the bearer bonds and whatever shenanigans they were up to in Nakatomi Plaza. But I don't remember when bean counters would have come up. You're gonna have to tell me. I don't know.
It was in Plane, Trains, and Automobiles.
Yeah.
We get Del Griffith talking about it.
Yeah. Well, because he's a traveling salesman, so he would know all about the budgets and bean counters and whatnot. Yeah. I should have gotten that. I feel bad.
Right. I mean,
bad podcaster.
Yeah. Well, I mean, again, he was talking about the beans. That was the whole idea.
Mm-hmm.
So we discussed a little bit back then also about that. And so basically, Walsh gets cut off as he's, trying to play this off, trying to get her to actually believe this tall tale that he is giving.
Mm-hmm.
And, that's how this minute ends. Did you have anything else for this minute?
No, I think we've pretty much covered it. The other thing is the, just how unbelievable this shift change story is. Because it seemed like if this really happens, where there's a huge outflow of everyone leaving at the same time, like I would think there'd be some criminals that would pick up on that. Okay, if you need to do some crimes, do it at noon on a weekday because it's shift change and no one's watching the store. It's almost like a citywide blackout for a few minutes. But yeah. But other than that, that's it. I think we've done good justice for what we see here in 49.
Okay, so from my experience and from what I know about how police work, when you do have a shift change, there's always overlap. That's the mm-hmm. idea.
Well, good. As you know, should be.
So, you know, like one shift will start like a half hour beforehand, you know, that type of thing, in order to, you know, that you have double the amount of people on the same shift before you get to the next shift, before that begins.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's, you know, so the criminal element doesn't need to be alerted to the fact that, that there's being a shift change, because they're not going to be able to do anything. It's actually worse to try and commit a crime during the shift change, because that's when you have double the amount of cops.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. Yeah.
All right. All right. So getting into the script, here it says NYPD Police Dispatch, the switching center for all police communications. A row of 30 dispatchers sit at their phones. The pace is frantic. Obviously, the volume of calls has just drastically increased. Wanda Shepherd, the head dispatcher, a wiry, chain-smoking, frenetic woman, watches her staff. She turns and walks down the corridor, running into Sergeant John Turley, NYPD Chief of Internal Communications. Turley's natural calm is the mirror opposite of Shepherd's natural frenzy. Sergeant, we just quadrupled our volume in 5 minutes. What the hell is... Stop. Let me explain. For the rest of the day, we're handling all the department's communications. What do you mean, all communication? We're shutting down the police van. All calls will be handled through the switchboard, and I'm going to marry Donald Trump. Do you have any idea what kind of volume we're talking about? Turley takes her arm and pulls her towards the dispatch room. Stop. We will deal with this as best as we can. You want a volume? They move inside the dispatch room. So it's interesting.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I wonder if they're told why, or at what point they're told why they're shutting down the police band.
I would think that
controlling information is just not, you know, do they need to know in the switchboard why they're doing this?
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think at this point they don't tell them. I mean, they're going to find out later when she's back and Wanda's back and she says half of New York just called 911.
Yeah.
You know, after the disc jockey starts talking, or after mm-hmm. Simon talks to the disc jockey, that type of thing. All right. Yeah. Great. So every Thursday we have a segment called Off the Beaten Track Revenge Sibling Rivalry Edition, where my guest will give some sort of story about some sort of revenge that they have either enacted on someone else or was enacted upon them, or that they heard about or saw or something like that. You know, some sort of story, anecdote, adventure, misadventure, something has happened to them over the course of their life. So Sean, you have a story for us?
Yeah. Yeah. So I am a sibling. I'm one of siblings. I'm the middle child of three. I have an older sister and a younger brother. And my brother is, I should know this, but much younger, like 9-10 years younger. There was a big gap there. But my sister's close. It's 2.5 years or closer. And so this is a tale. So growing up, this is the time my sister broke my nose, and I think I was like 7 or 8. And so she would have been like 9, 10, 11. Again, she's like 2.5 years older, but we were someplace. We're at a friend's house. We're playing. We're at the park. I don't know, but we're walking home, and it was right around the evening rush hour, probably right around 4:30, 5 o'clock in the evening. There's lots of cars driving down the road, and it's the road we live on. It's a, you know, suburban residential area. So not like, we're not like on the side of a highway with cars rushing by at 70 miles an hour. You know, the cars are going, you know, 25 or 30 miles an hour in this residential area. And we come to a corner and we're crossing, and not even like the quote unquote main road or the larger road where all these cars are. We have to cross one of the side streets. So we're at the corner, and for whatever reason, just the volume of traffic, the number of cars is bothering me, and I'm worried about getting hit by a car and I won't cross the road. I won't go. And again, this is like a side street. And I don't even remember, any particular cars like turning off of the main road or onto the main road. Like they're just going parallel to the way we're walking. Like there's really nothing blocking us from walking, but the volume of cars is getting to me. I won't cross the street. And my sister is very insistent, like, come on, let's go. We've got to get home. And I'm like, no, I just, there's too many cars, too much traffic. I won't go. And so she punches me square in the middle of the face, right in my nose. And if I was being stubborn before, I certainly didn't feel like walking after. So my nose was broken. It's bleeding. I'm crying. I think she just grabs me by the arm. And at that point, my will to fight or my will to resist is gone. She manages to drag me home and cover, that I recover. I lived, obviously. It was not a fatal wound. So that was the time my sister broke my nose. So I thought that was a good sibling rivalry type story. But interesting, kind of fast forward a couple of years, I had like a bullying incident. I had some trouble with some of the kids at school. And my sister, being a little bit older, came in. It was very protective, saying like, no, this is and I think she knew. I think the person who was kind of causing some trouble with me, he had an older brother who was friends with my older sister. And she kind of sent word down like, no, this is my brother. It was kind of like, no, only I can pick on my brother. Like if anyone's going to bully him, it's going to be me. I'm the older sister, like, pulling older sibling privileges, that she was the only one who could bully me, and kind of called off, put the word out that, that it was not cool and not going to happen. So, we're very close now, and all is forgiven in terms of any punches thrown or whatnot. But so it kind of made me think about, what was the relationship between, Simon and Hans? Did they have, any disagreements, were punches thrown or any rough times, but then, probably came out, certainly then once what happened to Hans, in the first Die Hard, probably, Simon said, hey, no one can throw my brother off the top of a building. Only I can throw my brother off the roof of a building, kind of thing.
Okay. It makes sense.
What kind of dynamic played out, amongst those siblings? Yeah, so that's my story.
All right, very cool. Thank you very much for that. So why don't you once again tell people where they can find Sean German?
All right, so once again, I'm Sean. You can find me at nextscenepod.com, where we're at the Next Scene Podcast. We talk about all types of pop culture stuff. And then also coming up later will be Casablanca Minute, covering the Warner Brothers classic, 1 minute at a time.
All right. Excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Around Minute. You can find me on Instagram. You can find me on Facebook. Find me on Twitter. You can find me on my website, movieroundminute.com. And if you want to send me an email, you can send it to movierobminute@movierob.net. So, Sean, you want to come back tomorrow to finish off the week, even though right now you're about to, we're all about to experience, Independence Day weekend. So I don't know. Maybe you got big plans.
It's the shift change. The bean counters, they're worried about overtime. So you know what? Screw the budget and the overtime. I'm coming back tomorrow.
All right. Excellent. Looking forward to that. All right. So until tomorrow. Right. Yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.
Johnny comes marching home again. Hoorah. Hoorah. We'll give him a hearty welcome then. Hoorah. Hoorah! The men will cheer, the boys will shout, the ladies they will all turn out, and we'll all feel glad when Johnny comes marching home.